He got his start as an improv comedian, performing on one of the most famous stages in Chicago. But when comedy couldn't pay the bills, he dusted off an old skill, coding. He founded three companies before he even moved to Silicon Valley, then took a chance on a fast-growing startup that was getting an unusual amount of attention. That startup invented the tweet, once mocked as a way to describe your breakfast in 140 characters. It's now a $30 billion public company, the darling of celebrities and presidents worldwide, yet subject to the whims of Wall Street. Joining me today on Studio 1.0, Twitter CEO Dick Costolo. Dick, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Twitter now has some 300 million users, 500 million tweets on the platform every day.
Right.
Some hilarious, some illuminating.
Mine hilarious.
Yours always hilarious.
Yeah,
some
always.
Wildly inappropriate. Yours only sometimes. some world changing.
Yeah.
But I wonder, how do you deal with that on a daily basis as a CEO?
Well, I don't have to read them all, so it doesn't all affect me personally.
But a revolution can start at any moment.
Well, the fascinating thing about the platform is the different way in which it's used every day around the world and the sort of surprising moments that, you know, surface on the platform that you've never thought about or haven't even occurred to you.
The number of users has quadrupled since you became CEO. It's one of the most highly scrutinized, most mainstream companies
Nobody
in
scrutinizes.
The world.
What are you talking about? I don't know what you're referring
Investors
to.
I've
never been scrutinized.
Did you ever think you would be here when you were growing up in Detroit?
No, not at all. You know, when I was growing up in Detroit, I just took life as it happened. Most of my family and extended family was in the automobile industry. You know, my dad worked for Pontiac and my uncle worked for Ford and on and on. My dad's dad worked for Chrysler. So I only applied to the University of Michigan. You know, I didn't like go look at schools. When people say now, well, what were you gonna do if you didn't get into Michigan? Like, you know, that implies I had some sort of strategy around it all. I didn't.
Luckily you got in.
Luckily I got in. My dad did get me when I was, I guess, 14 or 15, one of the very early Radio Shack TRS Model 80 computers. And so I learned to program in BASIC on that. By the time I went to Michigan, I did know I'm definitely gonna study computer science, but I didn't know what I was gonna do beyond that.
And then when you got to the University of Michigan, you actually took some theater classes on the side.
My senior year, I had like 8 arts credits I had remaining that I needed to get, and I just thought, what's the thing I can take that will be the least amount of homework so I can focus on, you know, my operating systems class? And I figured that acting would be, you know, I'll show up and I'll say some lines in a play and that'll be great. Coincidentally, my first semester senior year, I started doing just stand-up at the university student union. So by my second term senior year, I was really like, I'm having a lot of fun with this, and decided I'm not gonna take any of the, you know, programming jobs I've been offered. I'm gonna try to go to Chicago and study at Second City and get in there. And
you worked with Steve Carell.
Steve Carell was in the first group I was in when I first got to Chicago. Rachel Dratch became a good friend of mine. Horatio Sands. It was just a really, really fun time.
So why'd you stop?
Well, unlike some of those people, I didn't get any of the things I auditioned for. So I eventually decided I need to go back to, you know, figuring out how I'm gonna make money.
I imagine people in the front row screaming at you in the Annoyance Theater, and I wonder if improv comedy is good training for dealing with Wall Street.
Well, I'll say this. I remember, you know, when you're improvising, your people are constantly yelling at the stage and so forth. I did this show, and about 3 minutes into this hour-long show, these delightful, drunk Australian people started yelling, you know, you suck, get off.
So you went into consulting.
Yeah, so the internet took off, and this is early 93. I remember us getting the ac.com domain for Anderson Consulting. And I just went off with a couple friends and started one of the first, you know, web design and development shops. Sold that, started working on what ended up being this really early group-based blog. We didn't call it blogging back then. And sold that, then started SpyOnIt, which was an alerts platform. Amazingly, we sold that in September 12th of 2000. We had a 1-year sort of a restriction on the stock and the sale. And so my birthday, September 10th. So I had this weird set of days on 9/10/01, being out to dinner and thinking like, okay, in 2 days, the stock lockup expires and it's gonna be, we're gonna have this financial situation I've never been in before, which will be great for us. And of course the next morning was 9/11. And by the time 9/12 rolled around, the stock markets were closed and that didn't happen. It made a profound impact on me because I went into my birthday thinking, well, that's it. Like everything's great and my life is, you know, changed forever and I don't have to work ever again. And then the next day, everybody's world changed. And I remember just thinking that whole next week, everything you think is possibly true can be changed in an instant. And you know, it became unimportant. And I really mean it when I say, since then, I've really had an attitude of, okay, but who cares? Because everything, I know everything can change in an instant.
So you did go on to start FeedBurner.
Did go on to start FeedBurner. We sold that to Google in June of 2007. And that's really
$100 million.
That's really where I got reconnected to Ev and Ev Williams, who I'd been talking to after he sold Blogger to Google. And we had known each other from way, way back.
Ev Williams, the co-founder of Twitter, who's still on the board.
And also member of the board of directors, yeah.
So how did Ev get you to come to Twitter? That was what, 2009?
2009, after I'd left Google, was gonna go start another company. And I got a private message on Twitter from Ev, who was about to have his first baby, and said, hey, I'm gonna take a paternity leave for a short period of time when the baby comes. Would you be willing to sort of help out here for a bit while I'm off and just help us out with some operational stuff? I said, sure, I'd be happy to. And after that conversation started with Ev, he said, well, what if it was more permanent than that? What if, you became COO here? I felt like those opportunities don't come along very often. They come along maybe once in a lifetime and I gotta go do it.
So it felt like a rocket ship. At the time.
I felt like it did. You know, it didn't have any revenue yet. It didn't have anyone working on any of that at all. I think there were 50 people when I joined.
Mark Zuckerberg described Twitter as a clown car that fell into a gold mine, according to Nick Bilton's book, Hatching Twitter, which I'm sure you've read. What was it like for you getting into that car?
Well, just because Mark Zuckerberg describes it that way doesn't mean that's what it actually is.
How would you describe it, if not in that way?
I would describe it as this remarkable, simple idea that became the broadcast platform for the world. And I think the great insight that we had was, instead of having these ads or this stuff that's off to the side of what everyone's doing, let's make the monetization engine and the business engine part of what everyone is already doing, the tweets. And that turned out to be something that, you know, frankly, lots of other companies, including Facebook, have taken from us and used to great success. You like the way I spun that around and turned them?
I do.
Maybe they're the copier.
The drama of Twitter's early days is well documented. We don't need to go into that, but I do want to ask you one question.
Yeah, it was a clown car.
Ev Williams stepped down in 2010
yeah.
as CEO. You became CEO. As Nick describes it, Ev was told he was fired and you were the new CEO. Then Ev said you wouldn't be a good CEO, so you were told you were fired before the board said, actually, you're hired. What actually happened?
I'm not going to go into all the details and the gory, the whole, palace intrigue stuff about all that. I'll say that there's a lot of stuff that's been written about it. Some of it you read and think, like, that's interesting. I don't remember that person even being in the same city that we were in at that time. It is what it is. Here we are. Ev and Jack and I now work really well together. Jack and Ev are still on the board. Those two run very successful companies in their own right. The beauty of this for both of them is that it's hard for anyone in the world to look at those two and say, well, they got lucky.
How often do you talk to them?
Pretty regularly. Jack and I, we have dinner every Tuesday night at Zuni Cafe.
Good.
Yeah,
good
on
chicken.
Market. Good chicken. Come for the roast chicken, stay for
They're gonna
else.
Love this.
Yeah. I'm basically walking around doing ads for Zuni Cafe. And then Ev and I talk regularly too. In fact, Ev and I are trying to figure out when we can get dinner next week. In fact, over email right now.
Mm-hmm. So do you feel like you have their support?
I think so, yeah. I mean, the short answer is yes. Jack really thinks about the product from a very, he'll have these product insights that come at Twitter from a very different angle. And then Ev always has this really firm grounding in the user that has gotten him where he is today, which is running his third successful company.
Tales of great founders and CEOs are so often boiled down into legend.
Yeah, here's the problem with, I mean, you haven't asked me your question yet, but I'm gonna comment on it anyway.
Okay. What is the myth and reality of Dick Costolo?
Well, I was gonna say, the problem is exactly that. People create this like mythology about people. but I think the reality is that everybody kind of has one or two superpowers and then lots of remarkable flaws.
So what's your superpower?
I think mine is that I'm very present inside the company. And as such, anybody in the company will feel like they can talk to me. There's no, yeah, that's crazy, but don't tell Dick that. He'll throw a brick at the wall and yell. We really do a good job of trying to get at the truth.
People always ask this question, where is Twitter going? What's Twitter gonna be when it grows up? Nobody says that about Facebook.
The challenge that we have is the distance between awareness of Twitter and engagement on Twitter. And that causes people to say, well, I don't get why I would use it, so I don't get what it's for. I deeply feel that the platform is the very best way to connect in real time to what's happening in your world.
Twitter is the very best way
right.
to connect to your world.
Things like live in the moment. This amazing thing I'm watching right now, live broadcasting, live video, are gonna be the future of the platform. I really think that that's the future of the platform.
There used to be more concern about how Twitter was gonna make money. Now Twitter's pretty good at making money.
By the way, it was in 2009, 2010, 2011. Sure, it's an amazing platform, but there's no way it'll ever make it. I mean, that was not just a concern. That was a, yeah, but it can't make money. And then I think we did a really good job of proving that wrong.
Now the concern is about user growth and product innovation. What are you doing to improve the core user experience?
For example, when you first come to the platform now and sign up for an account, you no longer have to go find 80 or 90 accounts to follow to get a great Twitter experience. We deliver you what we call an instant timeline of 70, 80, 90 accounts right away that we think are super high value based on either where you are or the couple things you've said you're interested in. We need to make it dead simple when something's happening in the world that when you come to the platform, you see those right away without even logging in.
There are companies out there that do messaging only or video only. What makes you think that Twitter can be all of these things in one?
I mean, this happens to me all the time on the platform. I'll see something on Twitter that's been publicly broadcast and I want to go have a private conversation about it. We already know that it accommodates all these use cases. One of the reasons I'm extraordinarily excited about live video, super extraordinarily. One, it's so easy. Two, it's gonna open up all these remarkable avenues for people to feel like they're teleporting into a moment across the world. The long form possibilities are limitless. The short form possibilities are limitless. I mean, think about Ferguson or Occupy Central or the plane in the Hudson as now being a live broadcast. Think that the next several years ahead of us with that kind of capability is gonna be extraordinary, super fun, and develop all sorts of new mediums for performers, for shows, for content. I really do think it's going to change the entire media landscape.
By some measures, one measure monthly active users, Instagram is bigger than Twitter. Why should Wall Street believe this isn't a plateau?
I think for the simple reason that we all inside the company believe in the future of Twitter, that the world will be a better place when everybody is on Twitter.
Five product heads in 5 years. Since you've been CEO, mm-hmm. Why is it hard to find a product head for Twitter?
I don't think that it's very important to me to always be thinking about the whether this is the right team for the company right now. And I tell my managers all the time that your job is to improve your team, not defend your team. one of the reasons I'm so proud of and so excited about the team we have right now is because I truly believe it's the best possible team for this company at this moment. And I feel like we've done everything necessary and made all the hard choices we've had to make to put this team together.
So how long is this team gonna last?
Well, I don't know. I mean, you can't ever say to yourself, this is the team for the next exact team for the next N days or months or years. You have to be evaluating these things constantly. What you can't do is leaving the pitcher in too long, you know? And I think that you always have to be evaluating whether this is the right team at this moment.
We mentioned the guys in the front row at the improv comedy show saying, you suck.
Heckling you. You suck. Not just you suck, get off. Keeping in mind that that was 3 minutes into a 1 hour show.
That leads me to
it didn't
you.
Didn't get better, by the way.
In one of the most high profile and scrutinized jobs in the world.
Yeah.
Some people say.
You suck, get off.
Exactly. How do you?
And I say, I've heard that before. Was it an Australian accent?
How do you deal
accent,
with
though?
That? How do you and your team deal with that? And how do you as a person deal with that when people say you should be fired?
I got invited to something a couple of years ago my daughter, I think, said, like, oh, you should totally go to that. And I said, well, I don't think I'm gonna go because I got invited to it because of what I am, not who I am. I got invited to it because I'm the CEO of Twitter, not because I'm Dick Costolo. So I've always tried to make sure I never pay too much attention to the, you know, CEO of the year stuff, because the worst CEO of the year stuff is, you know, right around the corner. I therefore don't get worked up or really, frankly, care too much when people say those things. In fact, I've had to make myself care a little bit about them only after I started realizing, oh, it could affect recruiting if people start thinking, well, I want to go to Twitter, but what if, you know, Dick's not there tomorrow and everything changes? So I have to make myself pay attention to that and talk to people we're trying to bring into the company about it and say, look, that's just not the case.
How does not being a founder affect your ability to lead?
Jack Dorsey can sit here and you can ask him, what were you thinking about when you first, you know, invented Twitter? You can't ask me that same question because my answer is I didn't invent Twitter. You can be a non-founder CEO and have real thoughtful opinions and even certainty about where something needs to be taken that's helpful to the company. I mean, I can tell you when Jack saw Vine and loved it and knew it was right away and brought it to me and talked about it, we have to do this. I felt the same way when Jess Verilli on my team, a corp dev team, came to me and talked to me about Periscope. Right away was, we have to make that part of the company. I mean, I'll tell you, my daughter, at the end of 2014, she texted me and said, Dad, I have bad news and good news. The bad news is, this article says you're one of the worst five CEOs of 2014. Okay, what's the good news? You're number five. The good news is you're number five. So I view that as a lesson that I've taught them, hopefully, about how to not get too carried away one way or the other about these things.
I was hoping you'd tell me about beekeeping.
Oh, so the beekeeping, the cool thing about the bees, I'll tell you, I particularly spend most of my time watching them. I mean, the whole way the hive works and what's going on and the crazy stuff that happens as the seasons change and the way they build and everything is fascinating. I love just watching them and hanging out and watching them.
And you bring honey to the office, I hear.
Well, to some people, you know, there's not an infinite supply. So some people get it, some people get it, and some people don't.
So what's next for Dick Costolo?
I'm doing what I'm doing. I'm like, you know, I told you, you know, when I grew up in Detroit, I was very much I'm taking life as it comes to me. I'm a big, big proponent of living in the moment and not getting too caught up in the past and not thinking too much about, you know, where am I gonna be 2 years from now? I just think that's not a good way to live. And sometimes, like in the case of Ev, you know, DMing me and saying, like, will you come and do this? Making a decision to do that, I think that's a good and fun way to live, and I try to teach my kids to think about it the same way.
It's a good way to be if you're the CEO of Twitter. It's all about the moment.
You know, the way we raise our kids and education in the US, et cetera, is you're constantly trying to, like, I have to do this to get into this school. I have to do this to get an A. I have to get this score to do X. And you're constantly being trained to meet and exceed expectations. And then, you know, then you go out in the world and there aren't any expectations, there's just life. And so trying to teach my kids to life isn't about always, you know, meeting and exceeding expectations. It's about being present and for, you know, for yourselves and for your friends. I think that those end up being great people.
Dick Costolo, thanks so much for joining us. It's so great to have you.
Thanks for having me.
Boom.
Fist bump.